Support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT. Tom Stoppard returns to ACT with Indian Ink, direct from its sold-out run in New York. Limited performances run January 14th through February 8th at the Geary Theater. ACT-SF.org.
Support for the California Report comes from the California Healthcare Foundation. Ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court reflects on how Governor Jerry Brown is reshaping the judiciary and the trouble with California's death penalty. Plus, what's causing all this beautiful dry weather that's only making the drought worse?
These pressure patterns in the upper atmosphere define the wind flow, and where the wind's coming from defines sort of where the storm track is and whether or not California receives it's wintertime precipitation.
Also, as the Super Bowl nears, a new stage play explores how our view of football is changing as we learn more about concussions.
There have been intense conversations about the violence of the game, the brutality of the game, and the safety of the players. Through every generation, we knew what the risks were.
It's the California Report. The name Tani Kantil Sakaue may not mean much to most Californians. But in 2010, former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger chose the appeals court judge to be the new Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. She's seen a lot of change there in the past 4 years. Governor Jerry Brown appointed three new associate justices who had never been judges before, all under the age of 45. This week, I sat down with the person colleagues call simply Chief to talk about those changes and other issues facing the court. I began by asking her why we should even care about things like how well-funded courts are, since most of us will never have to deal with judges or courtrooms, especially the California Supreme Court.
Well, there were 7 million filings of court cases in California last year, and the law is for everyone, and the judicial branch is the third branch of government that performs a check and a balance on the legislative act and on the governor's act. People should care because the law affects so much of our lives, our neighbors' lives, our cousins', our relatives' lives, and those laws matter, and we believe we have a guaranteed right to them. And where do you test that? In a court of law.
Yeah. There have been so many changes on the high court in California. Yes. Three new members just since you've joined. You've been on the court 4 years and a few days. Mm-hmm. In fact, you took office the same day Jerry Brown did, and he's now made three new appointments to the court, none of whom had any experience previously on the bench. What difference does that make?
I think time will tell on whether that makes a difference or not. But I will say that Justice Liu, with whom I've had 4 years now of service, hasn't had on boots on the ground experience in a courtroom, either as a trial lawyer, as a trial judge, or an appellate justice. But he's a wonderful colleague. He's brilliant. And the other two, Justice Tino Cuellar and Justice Leandra Kruger, have the same kind of background. They're thoughtful, they're scholarly, and they appear so far to be very deferential to the trial courts and understanding of their role.
He's also appointed between, I think, 200 and 300 judges at all levels of the courts. And mm-hmm. One thing I've noticed is he's appointed a lot more people who have defense attorney backgrounds, former public defenders, whereas in the past it was almost all prosecutors, DAs, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
I haven't noticed that about him, but I realize that he looks at the trial attorneys and the trial judges, I think, differently. He's really looking for people who have thought about the law differently.
I want to move on to the death penalty. Some 900 inmates have been sentenced to death in California. Only 13 have been executed over the past few decades. The last one was in 2006. There's now more than 740, I think, inmates on death row. The leading cause of death is old age and suicide. Is the death penalty in California working?
It depends how you define working. Is it a law that we are working as a court to implement? Absolutely we are. 25% of the California Supreme Court caseload is dedicated to the automatic appeal death penalty case and to the habeas corpus petition that accompanies every single case. So are we working on these? Absolutely. They have anywhere from 18 to 32 to 40 claims in these kinds of cases on appeal. The Supreme Court answers every single one of these responses. Now, in terms of the length, it takes time. It's expensive. They're entitled to appropriate and reasonable representation. It takes time. It costs money.
Is it dysfunctional?
Is it working? Well, you said the numbers yourself. We have over 740 inmates on death row. We have 13 who've been executed. And it's difficult to say that it is working.
Is it fixable, given the political realities in California? Some say it could be fixed with more money, but then many say, you know, we're a Democratic state. Democrats don't want to see it fixed. They don't want more executions. Maybe we should just get rid of it.
I'll put it this way. There's no talk in the legislature about fixing the death penalty.
Therefore,
it doesn't seem to be a priority, but we are continuing to work at more efficient ways.
I want to ask you about a high-profile case from the past year. Sergio Garcia, an undocumented immigrant who went to law school, wanted a law license. Your court, an opinion I think you wrote, said that he should be entitled to be admitted to the bar in California, even though he was an undocumented immigrant. What does that decision say about the way this court looks at citizenship?
Well, what it says is what this court looks at in terms of admission to the bar. So that case was solely about whether or not Mr. Garcia was authorized under California law and federal law to be able to obtain a license. It wasn't about employment. It was about a license. And as you know, prior to that case being argued, after the case was argued in front of the California Supreme Court, the legislature stepped in and changed the law in California that made it permissible that a person like Sergio Garcia could obtain a license if they met all other requirements. What that says to me is what California is. It's a very progressive, forward-thinking, diverse state.
Does it undermine the value of citizenship when you're saying you don't need a citizenship to get a driver's license, get a law license, a professional license? Does it undervalue it? Does it devalue it?
I don't think it devalues it. I think it tells you that our legislature passes laws after a healthy debate, and this is what came forward.
So you took office the same day Jerry Brown did. I think it was January 3rd, 2011. Mm-hmm. And you've had to talk with him. You've had to lobby him for your budget. You've now have three new colleagues that he's appointed. What do you make of Jerry Brown?
I find him an interesting and fascinating person, and I can never judge where the conversation will go or where it will end. But he's inquisitive, he's curious, and I find every time I go and speak with him that it lasts longer than we both anticipate.
What do you make of his view of the courts, given that he's now appointed three people, none of whom had judicial experience, all of whom were smart academic types from Yale Law School? What does it tell you about where he wants the court to go?
I think he is looking for new thinkers, bigger thinkers.
What does that mean, bigger thinkers?
I mean, obviously, thinkers who are not judges, who are not trial attorneys. He's looking at folks who bring a broader and different kind of experience. It's a diversity of sorts, I think, that he's looking for, because he, of all people, knows the diversity of California and the direction we're going.
All right. Chief Justice Tani Cantil-Sakauwe, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Scott.
All that rain we had in December got us thinking, maybe, just maybe, this drought is ending. But no. Since then, the weather has been, well, really nice, which of course is really bad. In fact, most parts of California are on track for a record dry January, and that likely means a fourth straight year of drought. Some ski resorts are closed. No snow. So what's going on? Where did all the rain and snow go? KQED science editor Craig Miller says the answer has been sitting over our heads for weeks.
It's become a regular feature of the local weather segment.
We are showing you high pressure firmly in control right over us. That's bringing us the generally clear skies.
Those winter storms that had us scrambling in December.
About 14 trees have come down so far in San Francisco.
Have dried up. We had some bursts of rain, including one big blustery atmospheric river storm, but by Christmas... If this sounds familiar, flash back to the beginning of 2013, when after a similarly soggy December, the taps suddenly shut off with the new year. It turns out that a big bloated bubble of high-pressure air parked itself over the West Coast and did not move. It caught the eye of Daniel Swain, a 25-year-old doctoral student in climate science at Stanford.
It was going on and on, well beyond that 2-3 week sort of maximum that we normally see and persisting over months.
He started writing about it on his California weather blog and decided to give it a name.
The Ridiculously Resilient Ridge, yes.
And it stuck. In fact, the triple R, as it's now known in shorthand, has become enough of a thing that it even has its own Wikipedia page. Now, pockets of high and low pressure, meteorologists like to call them ridges and troughs, are a regular feature of California's weather, moving through the region like waves.
These pressure patterns in the upper atmosphere define the wind flow, and where the wind's coming from defines sort of where the storm track is and whether or not California receives its wintertime precipitation.
Or doesn't. When we're in a low-pressure trough, the usual winter storm track in the Pacific is ushered right into California.
But when it's pushed further north, as has been the case when we see these big ridges of high pressure occur over the eastern Pacific Ocean, that storm track gets shifted well to the north into British Columbia, into Alaska.
Or as Bay Area TV weatherman Paul Deano puts it,
it's like a bouncer in the sky. Storm? Nah, you can't come in. Storm from up here? Can't make it. Storm from down? No, nothing makes it here with the ridge right over top of us.
They're like boulders in a small stream of water that deflect the flow of the water to either side of the boulder.
In this case, that stream is the jet stream, the high-level winds that are the conveyor belt for California's rain and snow.
And that's kind of literally true, because these pressure patterns in the atmosphere are actually defining fluid flow, except in this case the fluid is the air in the atmosphere rather than water in a stream.
Now, here we are again with an obstinate ridge parked over us. And even though some cities got nearly 3 times their normal amount of rain in December, with that conveyor belt diverted again, this month is starting to look like a bust. No significant rain since December 21st. What we don't know is how much longer this will last.
The reason why the Ridiculously Resilient Ridge was remarkable in the first place is because it was really long-lived.
California state climatologist says last year, very cold air in the eastern half of the country, like an elephant in the road, blocked the ridge from moving eastward. It's hard to say if this year's ridge is the triple R back for an encore or just a spell of dry weather that happens during California winters.
But this is a really critical time of year, and if this high pressure that we're seeing right now does persist, then we do need to start thinking about potential that we're looking at another dry year, despite the fact we saw so much rainfall in early December.
Some other things we don't know, whether this is some kind of new normal, and if it is, whether human-induced climate change is to blame. What we do know is that winter doesn't last all year. January is the middle leg of a 3-month stretch in which California typically gets half its precipitation. And while there have been March miracles,
at some point, time runs out.
That's right.
For the California Report, I'm Craig Miller.
And now, graffiti. Depending on your point of view, it's either a blight on the urban landscape or street art, a kind of personal expression. And though some graffiti artists do have real talent, the fact remains, it's vandalism, and it's illegal. But a Santa Monica group is trying to get these talented taggers off the streets to turn their creativity into cash. KPCC's Adrian Florido reports.
Today, artist Bobby Rodriguez sells his work out of a small showroom on Santa Monica's Main Street. Spray-painted portraits, landscapes, modern depictions of the Virgin Mary.
I have a whole section over here where I have apparel, different graphics on shirts. This whole space here is mine. The California Bear has been really successful here in Santa Monica. People love that thing.
But Rodriguez didn't always sell his art. At 13, he started doing graffiti in his L.A. neighborhood and soon was tagging up walls and billboards all over Southern California. That vandalism led him to other crime. Rodriguez, who's now 25, describes himself as a hustler back then.
I don't want to go into much detail into criminality, but there's basically nothing I haven't done.
He was even arrested a few times. But when he had a son at 17, he decided to start straightening up. Yet that urge to paint never left him. One day he heard about a large graffiti wall near his home where kids could spray paint legally. He started going. Jonathan Mooney works for the nonprofit that set up that wall.
There's this misconception that graffiti is gang-related, and there's obviously some of that, but a lot of it is artistic expression. It's often creative young people who don't have a different channel for their creativity. And that, Mooney says, can get them into serious trouble.
There have been young people who have gone away for lifetime sentences for drawing on walls as a result of three strikes.
About 2 years ago, Mooney and a partner took the idea of the graffiti wall and spun it off into a new organization called Streetcraft LA. The group recruits talented kids like Bobby Rodriguez from the streets and from continuation schools and helps them sell their art. Streetcraft is part of that nonprofit that set up the graffiti wall years ago. Its Santa Monica showroom is where Bobby Rodriguez and other artists sell their work. But on a recent morning, it had been converted into a classroom. About 10 young artists are on laptops getting a lesson on how to use Adobe Illustrator to create their own designs. Eventually, their work will also be emblazoned on clothes, baseball caps, and other products, and sold out of this showroom and at stores that Streetcraft has partnered with. In the courtyard near the street, 18-year-old Rolando Martinez was finalizing a design for a new T-shirt.
It's just stuff I see in my neighborhood, you know. This one's a dumpster with an alleyway and some trash.
Martinez says he used to draw on his desks in middle school, and he used to watch his cousin tag buildings, but he never thought he could make money from his art.
I make the shirts and I make profit. You know, I get royalties, so half and half. Say they sell it for 20, I get 10.
Since last year, he's earned about $2,000 off sales out of Streetcraft's showroom, money he's used to pay tuition at West LA College. Streetcraft says it doesn't track how many kids give up tagging after taking its classes. But remember Bobby Rodriguez? He did. On a recent morning, I met him at Pacific Park on the Santa Monica Pier. Park spokesman Cameron Andrews walked us over to the carnival games.
The project was to paint each one of the roll-up doors that go to the Midway games.
The roll-up doors were covered in Rodriguez's art, 18 panels making up a giant ocean scene, dolphins, tortoises, fish. Rodriguez got this commission a few months ago with Streetcraft's help.
By the age of 15, you know, I already knew that I didn't want to be appealing to just a certain crowd. I wanted a bigger audience than just a graffiti culture.
And now how many people come through here, did you say?
More than 6 million people visit the pier annually.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, that's pretty much the type of audience that I want to continue working for and with.
The best part, Rodriguez says, he knows his work will be up for a while. No one's going to go over it with a paint roller. For the California Report, I'm Adrian Florido in Santa Monica.
This week's debut album from the San Francisco band Hidden in the Sun was 15 years in the making. The group says its music spans rock, blues, folk, and funk. The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hochman says their music is distinctive, but explaining just how it's different presents a challenge. Here's his review of Seven Seasons.
Hidden in the Sun is, simply put, a rock band. Guitar, bass, keyboards, and drums with a singer. That's it. No hyphenates, no techno garage, no ethno disco, no funk, jazz, soul, industrial whatnot. It's refreshingly straightforward. Or so it seems. As the band's name suggests, there's something here that's hard to discern. And as we've been hearing on Seven Seasons, the title track of the band's debut album, that's half the fun. It's all just slightly off-kilter in the best ways. Sean Alexander's guitar and Sierra McAllister's keyboards almost but don't quite mesh. Bassist Jason Vivrette and drummer Scott Rouse don't so much riff as flow. The music serpentining through songs stretching 5, 6, 7 minutes, as in Salt and the Spring. Yeah. the center, galvanizing it all, is the striking voice and approach of Lizzie Clapper. But how to describe her? If you can come up with any apt comparisons, pass them along. I've drawn a blank. But she sums it up herself, though in a different context, with a particularly poetic line on the song, Smoke Signals.
In our one's wise, a reef of clouds.
Led these five to the secluded cabin deep in the Mendocino Redwoods, where Seven Seasons was recorded, is curious and singular as well. McAllister and Rouse started playing 15 years ago in Tulsa. A few years later, McAllister moved to Northern California to run a music camp, where she and guitar teacher Alexander were taken with the talents of teen singing student Clapper. And from late night jams, a band was born. San Francisco blues, tapping into the countrified folk rock that has typified the California sound for generations, is a siren call to someone who's left. Matters of identity and place thread through the lyrics, mostly by Clapper and Alexander. Songs about trying to find where you belong, with whom you belong, connecting with something or failing to do so. So what connections can we make here? The band? Jefferson Airplane? Big Brother? A guitar lick here and organ line there might bring those names to mind, but they'll prove fleeting notions and ultimately off target. Even at times when the music is relatively straightforward rock, including much of the song My Magdalene, something about Hidden in the Sun remains alluringly elusive, just like smoke.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music for the California Report and KPCC. He reviewed Seven Seasons by Hidden in the Sun. Next weekend's Super Bowl is sure to include sounds like this.
Set, come on.
Bone-crushing collisions between players are just fundamental to pro football, but scientific evidence about head injuries is putting a whole new light on that part of the game and its impact on health. This weekend, the Berkeley Repertory Theater premieres a new original play about concussions in football. It's called X's and O's, A Football Love Story, and it's based on interviews with former pro players, their families, and their fans. The California Report's health reporter April Demboski takes it from there.
Suiting up for football practice is a chore, or a ritual, depending on how you look at it. This young actor layers on dozens of pads before pounding through these drills. Meanwhile, former players list the casualties they suffered in the game, despite all that protection.
I had 22 surgeries.
Oh, I have to count. I know I had 37 surgeries.
64 surgeries.
Blew out both Achilles.
Separated shoulder.
Broken collarbone, taped it up, back in the game.
Broken sternum.
One of those actors is Dwight Hicks. He's the real deal. He spent 6 years playing defense for the San Francisco 49ers in the early 80s. He's got his own list of residual injuries. I noticed one when I first shook his hand.
I had a ruptured tendon in this finger. I broke my hand. Rotator cuff, shoulder injuries.
But it wasn't until the early 2000s that Hicks realized there might be another injury lurking. That's when more and more retired football players began reporting symptoms of early-onset Alzheimer's. Others were showing personality changes, rage and depression, signs of a condition called chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
When this information started coming out, I was like, wow, this is something that I might have to deal with later on. It wasn't scary until some of the prominent players, guys that I knew, some guys that I played against, started to have this problem.
Playwright KJ Sanchez says this has thrust football into an identity crisis, and not for the first time.
There have been intense conversations about the violence of the game, the brutality of the game, and the safety of the players. Through every generation, we knew what the risks were.
Throughout the play, there are breaks in the narrative where the cast recites these historic milestones.
1869. Rutgers and Princeton play the first college football game.
In 1905, 19 players died playing football. The president of Harvard at the time, Charles Eliot, wanted to banish the game.
Today's football is a boy-killing, education-prostituting, gladiatorial sport.
Teddy Roosevelt, President of the United States, responds. The bruising nature of football instills manly virtues and builds strong bodies, when with each passing day, America risks becoming less rugged and virile.
The stage design is minimal. Just a few props rolled on and off stage shift the setting from a locker room to a medical examiner's lecture hall. That's where Sanchez sets the scene to talk about helmets. She says the more technically advanced helmets became, the worse the injuries got.
Because the better the helmet, the more invincible the player.
She wrote a team physician into the play to explain how these head injuries happen. CAT scans flash on the video screen behind her.
What happens is the brain. It's almost like a yolk inside of an eggshell.
It's the yolk hitting the insides of the eggshell that can lead to lasting injuries.
So better helmet does not keep your brain from sloshing around inside of its skull.
Sanchez is a football fan. At various times, she's rooted for the Green Bay Packers, the Patriots, and the Cowboys.
One of my very first girlhood crushes was on Tom Landry, which says way too much about me.
Through all the new science and political debate, Sanchez and her co-writer, Jenny Mersin, began to ask themselves whether they, as fans, had some responsibility for the players and for the fate of football itself.
We started to talk about how many conflicted feelings we had about loving the game, now understanding the significance of the damage that the game does.
In X's and O's, a football love story, they leave it to a table of fans at a bar to work through.
If football goes away...
It's not going to go away.
My family, we don't go to church, so football's our way of being part of something bigger. I have to admit, I'd be lonely.
They question how violent the game needs to be entertaining.
You know, I think I watch it for the moment, not when the guy gets knocked down, but rather the moment he gets back up. I think I need to remember we can get back up.
After the play runs in theater, Sanchez plans to take it to colleges and high schools. She wants to start conversations like these in the community, especially among young people who will decide whether to play or not, and how much of their future they want to bet on football. For the California Report, I'm April Dembosky.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director today is Nina Thorson. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Rob Spate. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Olivia Allen Price. Our interns are Michelle Dutro and Pyle Zaveri. The California Report's editorial team includes Susie Rocho, Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Andrea Kissick, Ingrid Becker, and Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.